The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, your number one news and talk station.
The Money Show, brought to you by Old Mutual, a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Get great financial advice. Do great things. Our reporter, Lindsay Dendlinger, has been in Parliament all day watching the unplucking of the story, the uncovering of the story around Anoush Singh, the former finance director at Eskom. We've also got Craig McCune standing by. He's with Amabungani Centre for Investigative Journalism, and they've been doing the equivalent, I don't know how best to describe it. It's a bit like a university drinking game. Every time somebody says something that's either not true or you've made up rules, you have to have a drink. What Amabungani have been doing today is every time they believe the witness, and that is Anoush Singh, is not telling the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, they've published a document on their Twitter feed to contradict the statement. So we'll talk all about that this evening. It's a really interesting way of going about it. Nicola Klein, Dean and Marketing Expert at Gibbs, is in Davos. We'll cross to her. It looks very, very cold. Henny de Klerk, Chief Executive of Treasury One, has won the rookie race at Dakar. We'll talk to him about that. And then Dominique Collett, we had her in last year, and she was so good on the science of fintech. We've invited her back to say, what does 2018 look like from a fintech perspective? This time last year, she was saying, Bitcoin, Bitcoin, rah, rah, rah. We know what happened. It went completely bananas. Does she still stick to the Bitcoin story, I wonder? All of that is happening on tonight's Money Show.
The Money Show.
Your number one news and talk station.
Watching Anoush Singh today, did you think he'd rather have a double booking at his friendly local proctologist rather than be giving evidence in Parliament? He was answering questions about his tenure at the power utility. He resigned while on suspension last night, but he still had to turn up at the parliamentary inquiry. Lindsay Dendlinger, there looked like a million places that Anoush Singh would rather have been today rather than in the hot seat in Parliament. He got quite uneasy.
Good evening, Bruce. Well, he's still in the hot seat. We're going on now for almost just on 4 hours, and he has not been allowed to get up from his seat just yet. He might be looking a bit uneasy on your TV screens, but he's not wavering much from his position that he's brought here, over 400 pages of documents, an almost 100-page affidavit, and he's pretty much sticking to what's contained in those, and just feigning ignorance if he is asked something that that doesn't just quite match up with what he's got in front of him.
Now, I mean, this is the guy who, the day before he was meant to appear toward the end of last year, dumped these 400 pages of documents on the parliamentary committee, who then sent him away and said, come back next year. This is that appointment, right?
This is indeed this appointment. He's apologized for that. He said it, it wasn't intentional. He's got his lawyer sitting right next to him. He's also said he's got, since that meeting that he was turned away from, he's since acquired additional information, but has decided not to table that in before the committee just yet. So what he's got is anyone's guess.
So, I mean, the facade then doesn't crack. Anoush Singh is in Parliament, 4 hours under cross-examination, and he's not yet cracked.
No, not really. I mean, a lot of what has gone on so far is rehashing, you know, information that has already come out in leaked emails. The evidence leader started by questioning him about his relationship with the Gupta family and also his frequent trips to Dubai. He's denied having any connection to the family other than saying he met them on occasion at breakfast meetings, and that he might just have been on at least one occasion in the same hotel at the same time in Dubai, and he might just have spoken to them in passing, but he assures the committee it was definitely not related to any business transaction at either Eskom or Transnet.
I mean, here's the quote. In all my interactions with the Gupta brothers, we never actually discussed, as I can recall, caveat, any business transactions or any related transactions related to Eskom or Transnet. So did he disclose what they did talk about? Can he remember?
No, he hasn't provided those details. From there, the committee, the evidence leader let that go and moved on to suggesting that as the chief financial officer, he smoothed the path for Tegeta to buy the Optimum mine, and suggesting that Eskom had given them preferential treatment. Again, Anoush Singh says not the case, And when that 2 billion rand fine was whittled down to about 577 million, he says, in fact, Eskom's actually gained from that transaction because it was always the contention of Glencore that no money was owed to Eskom. So in his view, the Tegeta didn't get off lightly at all, and Eskom gained by actually getting money out of it.
I mean, if he's as squeaky clean as he seems to suggest he is, why did he resign last night? Has anybody asked that question yet?
He has not been asked why he resigned. The only reference he made to his suspension, he was asked a question about why the board was not informed about the guarantee that was granted to Tegeta. He said it was his understanding that we should by process that would have filtered down to the board. And he said before he could try to establish why the board was not informed about that, he was suspended and he didn't have access to the documents. So that's the only reference he's made to being suspended. He has not been asked why he's resigned, but that might still come as when MPs get their chance to ask questions.
So when you look at the amount of time he's likely to spend in the hot seat in Parliament tonight, based on previous appearances by Lynn Brown and others, this could go on a while.
It could go on a while. It's my understanding that they might they were due to take a break about half an hour ago. I'm seeing some of my colleagues leaving the room right now, so it might just be that they're taking that dinner break. But I suspect they're nowhere near getting through all the information that they want to question him on. So it's my guess that it will continue for a couple of more hours tonight.
Lindsay Dantlinger from Eyewitness News, thank you. Craig McCune, investigative journalist with Amabungani Center for Investigative Journalism. You've been playing the equivalent of bulldust bingo and releasing documents every time Anoush Singh has struggled to remember something or has delivered a different version of the truth that the documents suggest is, in fact, accurate. How many red cards have you issued this afternoon so far?
I wish I could say that was me. I was working on something else. I haven't had the pleasure of listening to Anoush Singh, but I looked at our Twitter account now to see what Sally and Susan have been up to. I don't know. The biggest red cards are around his Dubai trips, where he says he may or may not have walked past the Guptas in the lobby. You know, that's just impossible to believe. Absolutely impossible to believe. He didn't discuss any business with any Transnet business with any of the Guptas or any of their staff. Well, that's also pretty difficult to believe when you look at the 30 billion rand in Transnet contracts that were awarded under his watch and the 6 billion rand in kickbacks that we've identified alongside those contracts that flowed to and through Gupta-related companies. So the pattern is not in his favor at all, nor is the clear, direct evidence.
I lost track of how many of these documents you published, as Amabungani, on your Twitter feed this afternoon, but there must have been at least a dozen each time there was a disagreement on the facts. Amabungani seemed to have a document to back up the question that was being asked of Anoush Singh.
Well, let's look at his Dubai trips. So I got some things in front of me. We actually counted seven Dubai trips that were arranged by the Guptas. We know this because it was on the Guptas' computer network. They communicate with the hotels. They arrange the bookings. They book the rooms. And then I'll quote from an email from the hotel staffer over at Oberoi in Dubai. With approval of Mr. Gupta, we also charged the credit card which you provided to us for Mr. Singh charges. And this is for a luxury suite. The guest name is Anoush Singh. And Rajesh Gupta and Salim Essa were there too on the same booking. I can go on. Grover, their bagman, swiping his credit card for Singh's bills. There's approval sent from Ashutola to Tony Gupta saying, you know, can we pay for Singh's bill? And Tony says, okay.
This parliamentary process then, Anoush Singh looks like he is taking the mickey out of the parliamentary process. These are all documents in the public domain. No doubt the cross-questioning is going to heat up later on this evening when some of these documents are then presented to Anoush Singh in Parliament.
I hope so. And I hope he gets asked who this Mr. A. Singh is, who the Guptas paid 600,000 rand in Dubai. And the shell company AS Global that was set up in parallel and also received 600,000 rand. And the shell company called Venus Limited, which was set up in Ras Al Khaimah, a financial haven, secrecy haven over in UAE, and which was set up by the Guptas for Anoush Singh. They gave it to him. Why?
Well, Craig McKeown, hopefully somebody in Parliament on their supper break, thank you, is listening to our discussion and will ask those questions. Yeah, it's such an interesting way of doing journalism in the 21st century. Here, Amabungani have got all of these documents, and every time Anoj Singh has told a porky, Amabungani have published a document to say, no, we remember it differently, and here is a piece of paper with some evidence.
The Money Show. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
I was so excited to get into the Anoj Singh story that I forgot completely about our fast fact today. How dare I forget about our fast fact? So here's your fast fact question. Who is not to blame for the disappearance of Zuma? Who is not to blame for the disappearance of Zuma? Give us an SMS right now on 31702 31567. It's official. There is someone who's not to blame for the disappearance of Zuma. That's answer coming up in a couple of minutes.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. I'm Bruce Whitfield, and it is 21 minutes past six on this Monday evening. Bright Kamalo is a portfolio manager at Vestact on a day where the JSE went to a record close. We haven't had one of those for a couple of days. The all-share index to 61,450 or thereabouts, Bright. I mean, it's so nice to see a really good rebound in retailers and in the banking sector.
Yes, mostly SA Inc. stocks, like you're saying. That's, you know, on the back of the stronger rand. We saw that at 12 rand, 11 cents to the US dollar. So it's very interesting times. And if you're not in SA Inc. yet, I think you're in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, and it was all about people who were prepared to take a bet that the ANC would pull itself and the country back from the brink of self-destruction in December. And those who didn't. And foreigners have been such big sellers of South African shares.
Correct.
I mean, they went from big, massive shareholders, for example, in something like a ShopRite to less than 40-50% in ShopRite, for example.
Yeah.
And now they're scrambling to get back in again.
Again, that's, you know, that proverbial door that everyone's trying to get in now. You know, it's not too late, I guess, in South Africa, in South African terms, in terms of our market. Still very undervalued, I think.
A guy called Roy Topol on Twitter today said, if you'd invested in South African banks exactly 2 years ago today, you would be up 74% in rand terms. If you were a foreigner, and this is what's so interesting about it, because of the fluctuations in the exchange rate,
yeah.
In dollar terms, your return would be 138%. Foreign investors, with a little bit of faith and a little bit of patience, would have done twice as well as local investors in rands.
Yes, and he chose 2 years ago because of, you know, in December, it was that Nenegate saga.
Yeah.
So that's what he's talking about there. And I know a couple of, bank analysts and fund managers that backed themselves and actually did buy more at that time. So those guys are smiling and smiling all the way to the bank.
They are, literally. And by the way, Nhlanhla Nene, the guy who started all the trouble, it was his fault, really. Here's our shapeshifter tomorrow night. My producers were so worried because they'd arranged with Nhlanhla Nene to come in as our shapeshifter tomorrow night, on Wednesday night. They then were watching over the weekend as it looked like he might become the next chairman of Eskom. And if he'd become the next chairman of Eskom, he wouldn't be coming tomorrow night. So on that basis, we're grateful that Jabu Mabuza got the job.
Well, we're happy Jabu got the job then.
Yeah, absolutely. And Nhlanhla Nene is destined for great things. And we look forward to welcoming him in studio on the next Money Show. Banking shares are flying. I mean, First Rand at record level, 69 rand a share. Standard Bank over 200. Barclays Africa heading toward that sort of level. Nedbank strong too.
Yes, I mean, okay, look at the top 40 winners and losers today. Okay, we'll focus on the winners. Mr. Price up 4.7%. Star,
Sign off Africa Retail.
Correct.
That has got back to the levels it was at when Steinhoff collapsed.
That's the important part here. And it's like you're saying, that's up 4% today. First Rand, like you're saying, all-time highs up 3.95%. So again, that SA Inc. story just, you know, pounding.
And you're saying it's not too late for investors to buy South African-focused shares because the price of the share, and if you look at the price of a share as being a multiple of last year's earnings, have been very, very low. That loss of confidence in ourselves and of everybody in our market is now returning.
Yes, and most importantly, SA Inc stocks are driven a lot by consumer confidence, and there hasn't been a lot because there's been lots of money outflows into South Africa, like you were saying previously. The richer types of South Africa sending lots of money offshore, moving offshore, some of them. And if you look at now where we are today, we're even third on the Optimist Index. This year's Optimist Index. It's insane. It shows you that there's going to be a lot of positivity coming out of South Africa. And if the consumer feels like the environment is good to spend, they want to spend more on clothes, food, and all those SA Inc stocks, retailers, banks, the likes of Dis-Chem, Clicks, all of those companies are going to do exceptionally well. That's just my analysis of the market.
And that's what the market is telling us as well. Lewis was up a huge 18% today. They came out with a trading update early this morning. They've been under so much pressure in recent, for the last 3 or 4 years, lots of accusations of their business model, and there've been investigations into the way in which they charge interest, all sorts of terrible things.
Correct.
Yet they seem to have pleased the market.
Yeah, I mean, like you're saying, you're talking about the ongoing impact of the National Credit Act. Now the most recent one is on the affordability assessment regulation. That's what they call it. So they've been, granting debts to people who can't afford the stuff. And, that's not good. So they were complaining about this for a longest time. But now back to the numbers. Their sales were looking good. Their quarter numbers were up about 9.8% for the 9 months, up 7%. That's obviously on the back of a very, very low base, like you're saying. And if you look at the group numbers altogether, those revenues were up about 0.7% for the quarter. That's an improvement from, being down 3.2% the last reporting period, if you do the comparable numbers. So again, this is a story of, it's a local story. Furniture is not exactly that exciting, I think, but you have to work with what you're given.
And look, it's always been a very high margin business, and they've always made so much money out of financial services because of the way they have charged poor people over long periods of time, and that's why people have made money out of it. But that model is broken.
Yes, you're a bit smarter than me. I was going to get to that point. you went there before me. Sorry. Yes. So that's where the cream was, because they can charge. They could charge unlimited amount of in terms of interest, right? And now that's being regulated heavily. You can't charge 35% on furniture. That's insane. If you for 36 months or whatever the periods you agree with your customer. So
Stephen Mulholland, former editor, former big boss at Times Media Limited, told us he'd written as a journalist about it 50 years ago. They were getting away with it then, and until recently have been getting away with it as well. You don't only look at South Africa. One of the most exciting companies, among the most exciting companies in the world, we saw the new Uber chief executive talking about being profitable in 3 years.
Yes.
David Frankel, ex of Internet Solutions, who's an early Uber investor, will be happy about that. of course, Facebook is very exciting, and Amazon's very exciting. But Netflix is changing fundamentally.
Yes.
The way the connected world is consuming entertainment.
Media. Yes. This is what I was telling one of my colleagues, Byron, I was listening to actually a podcast where a guy that founded Expedia basically was talking to Reed Hastings at the time, saying, "You need to come join my board." And he says, "But you guys sell DVDs. What's the story there?" It's like, no. Our name is Netflix. It's not DVD Flicks. Get it? And that guy said he's basically a venture capitalist investor as well. And he invested a lot of his funds money into Netflix at the time. It was around 2008, 2007. And they've made a killing, basically, because Netflix has gone from like a dollar to $240, $250 today. And they came up with their quarterly numbers as well, and full year numbers, subscribers at 8.3 million. That's the ones that they added on that quarter specifically, of which 6.3 million are just, non-US subscribers. This is a story now of an international story, meaning non-US now, because they've proven themselves as a brand in the US that they're very good at doing this, and they're number one there. And now it's about, expanding further. And I know a lot of people who are using, illegal ways to get access to Netflix. Now, if they can hear that Netflix is coming to their country, they can stop all of that and just subscribe subscribe to Netflix normally, and it's so
and
cheap.
It's cheap. That's
and
the point.
Yeah, it costs about two Starbucks coffees, and you know, for a month, that's very cheap. And I think this is the big sector if you're looking, you know, in terms of growth going forward. This is where fortunes are going to be made and lost going forward here, and it's going to be interesting to watch Amazon how they reply to the $6.5 billion investment yearly on new content, creating new content by Netflix, because they invest about $2 billion. So it's going to be interesting going forward here.
It's going to be absolutely fascinating. I remember going to see a friend of mine in the Bronx in New York in 2008, and he said, look at this cool thing. These guys send us DVDs in an envelope. We watch it, and then we post it back to them. It's called Netflix. It's going to be huge. Like, yeah, whatever. That'll never work. Well, and now they stream the movies. Brian Kamalo, Portfolio Manager at Vest Act, on The Money Show this evening, wrapping up today's market activity on the JSE. Your fast fact question: who is not to blame for the disappearance of Zuma? Do you want to have a go?
I have no idea.
It's Elon Musk, the other ticker. Because remember the Zuma project? It's like 2 weeks old now. The Zuma rocket disappeared.
Yeah.
It was called Project Zuma. Well, the U.S. Air Force Command says Elon Musk's SpaceX company not responsible for the disappearance of top-secret military payload destined for space earlier this month. The military says it remains confident in the company's capabilities. SpaceX says its Falcon 9 rocket apparently did everything correctly in the mission codenamed Zuma. But Zuma went off track and crashed and burned and has not been seen since.
The Money Show,
your number one news and talk station.
The Money Show is brought to you by Old Mutual, a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Get great financial advice. Do great things. On the next Money Show, Nhlanhla Nene, former finance minister, the current chairman of Grow Fresh Produce, and lots of other things too, is this week's shapeshifter. So nearly the chairman of Eskom, but if he'd become the chairman of Eskom, he wouldn't have been able to join us in the Money Show studio. He'd be trying to fix the country. Then Colin Cullis on Business Unusual questions whether companies that turned you into a couch potato could do an about turn and become your fitness coach. That's all coming up on the next Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield.
Now, not that you should support vengeance of any kind as a healing strategy. It's hard, though, not to get that little happy tingle up your spine listening to this story. The former partners at Bell Pottinger, those nice people who paid by the Guptas, spread dissent and bile in South Africa. They are now angry about how much it is costing them to wind up the company which collapsed last year. The firm has had to pay about 12, maybe 13 million rand, depending on the exchange rate you use, to lawyers and accountants, BDO, as part of the winding up process. Sometimes, you know, sometimes when lawyers charge a hefty fee, you can't begrudge the lawyers. Only sometimes. And in this case, certainly.
To The Money Show. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Well, the theme at the 48th annual World Economic Forum at Davos in Switzerland this year, laced with irony as some of the world's richest and most powerful people jet into this little alpine village, which is bedecked with snow. It's absolutely beautiful this year. They've had a huge snowfall. They go for 3 days of sharing ideas, networking, doing deals. The theme, and that's the ironic part, how can we create a shared future? And they do it as far away from everybody as they possibly can. It comes as Oxfam claims that the world's 1%, or the richest 1%, received 82% of the wealth generated worldwide last year, and the poor got none of it. Professor Nicola Klein is the dean and marketing expert at Gibbs, on the line to us from Davos in Switzerland. You're not part of the official Team SA delegation, Nicola. You're there off your own bat, or on the bat of Gibbs, are you?
That's correct, Bruce. Good evening and welcome from the snow. So I'm here because we were invited to be part of a function that focuses on business schools. And it's around that time when deans of business schools go from place to place. So the annual EFMD deans meeting is in Munich tomorrow. So they timed it pretty well. But I must say it's been fascinating. And I have to stop you on jetting in because poor Prime Minister Modi yesterday actually had to drive in because he couldn't chopper in because there's the highest risk of avalanche here in Davos that apparently they've had on Livort. So the ski lifts are closed. There's snow everywhere, but the sun came up today, so that was good.
I saw the pictures of blue skies today. Is it your first time in Davos? Nicola?
Hello.
Hello. And is it your first time in Davos, Nicola?
It is, Bruce. So it's a fascinating experience watching. Can you hear me, Bruce?
Absolutely clearly. You carry on.
It is, yes. It's my first time here.
And tell me what the
can
experience...
Can you hear me, Bruce?
Yeah, we can hear you perfectly. Tell me about the experience of being
okay,
there
fantastic.
For the...
Fantastic. So you've come through.
Your experience of being there for the first time, what does it feel like to you as somebody who helps shape the minds of bright young people in South Africa? What's the experience like for you in Davos this year?
It's a little bit surreal being there because, as you said, there have been criticisms that really this is where the elite come. And within the sense of being here, there's absolutely no doubt that there are circles within circles within circles. I mean, the one thing that really strikes you, of course, is the military presence. And with all of these heads of state, 318 politicians, odd, 3,000 official members, that's tight. But they're quite determined to be egalitarian in their approach. So, for example, I haven't had to show any identification solely to pick up my pass, which gives me access to all the hotels and also some parking. But it's extraordinarily well managed. And then it's just fascinating watching all of the people also that are clearly supporting the major participants. So there are conversations going on all over the place. I think I've seen one South African scarf, and it was driving past, and I couldn't see who it was. So it's an enormously busy place with only 400 sessions that are, 400, sorry, in total that are happening across the conference. I don't think anybody can get a bird's eye view of Davos. You're probably better looking at it from an outside perspective.
But do you get the sense, though, at all, that there is a sense of nervousness about... I got the sense 2 years ago when I was last there. I got the very clear sense that there was a sense of nervousness about global inequality, and the theme this year seems to be trying to address that.
There's no doubt that that's on the radar very firmly. You know, it's a theme that I think sits well with us at our own country level, this notion of creating a shared future in potentially a fractured country for us in South Africa. You know, what's coming through, I think, is they're struggling to manage it because I don't know if you saw the economic outlook that was released yesterday, but some of Bagar's comments it's looking pretty rosy. Global economic growth has grown. And at the same time, there's a lot of cautionary soundings that say this is not off a sustainable base. So a couple of concerns from an economic perspective that says the world is heavily indebted. And as we see these sort of crises, nobody's calling them that, of nationalism, but certainly Modi is calling for globalism. I think everybody's going to see what Trump says with bated breath. But we can't afford to go into a global recession. And what they're arguing is that inequality will be the driver of this. So hard when you've got all of these guys who are responding very favorably to a relatively rosy outlook economically, but at the same time they're talking about fractures underneath and within the system.
Have a wonderful time at Davos in Switzerland, Professor Nicola Klein. Pop into the Kirchner Museum. It's got a big fat South African flag plastered on the side of it. You can't miss it. It's a dean at that Gibbs, the Gordon Institute of Business Science, at the 48th Annual World Economic Forum gathering at Davos, Switzerland. The theme, how can we create a shared future? Far away from that shared future. You might not have known that there's a rookie section to the Dakar Rally. And if, like me, you didn't realize the Dakar Rally had moved to Latin America, well, then smack on head. Henny de Klerk and Gerard Schutte, South Africans, bought their locally built Amarok over the finish line to be first among the rookies. The chief executive at Treasury One is Henny de Klerk. Were you driving or were you navigating?
Driving.
Driving. So you did the hard work.
Yeah, well, the navigator would say the easy part, you know, so...
But he had to think. You just had to concentrate.
Absolutely, yes, yeah.
How rough was it?
Yeah, no, it was tough. It was an awesome experience, but it was, like I just said, Carlos Sainz said, it was one of the worst or most difficult Dakars that he's experienced. It was almost 10,000 kilometers, of which 4,500 kilometers was race kilometers. And between 12 to 13 hours easily a day in the car for 14 days. We had one rest day, which is day 8. But the rest of the time, you were in the car from sunrise to sunset. You'll pull away because they've got these crazy liaison stages. In between, you'll do a 200, 300 kilometer liaison. Then you get to a rally stage. And then you do a 300 kilometer rally. Then you do another 300 kilometers to the next town.
But you do this a lot. How are you still a rookie? How do you get classified as a rookie?
No, it's my first time. It's the first Dakar.
The first Dakar.
It's the first Dakar.
But you do quite a lot of rally driving.
Yes. Yeah. In the local series. Yeah. Oh. I arrive in the SACS, South African Cross Country Challenge. I've been doing that for 5 years. So yeah, I'm an experienced driver from that point of view. So
but a Dakar rookie.
It's a Dakar rookie.
And on your first outing, you win it.
Yeah, we were lucky enough in June, late last year, there's the Toyota Desert 1000. They've got the Dakar Challenge. We've entered for it. I won it. And then it means your entry fee is paid for the Dakar. And then it was just final preparations. And then the 1st of January, we had to fly. And the 6th of January, we had to official start in Lima, Peru. And then, ended in Cordoba on the 20th.
Just over a third of the cars that started actually finished. And yours was one of two of 17 rookie cars that finished. I mean, that's hell on wheels.
Yeah. That shows you how tough it was. The other interesting thing was that the amount of time that we spent in race time, the race leader lot this year spent double the amount of time he did last year. So 2017 hours spent was half 2018. So Carlos Sainz, double the amount of time that he spent. So that's how difficult it was this year. So it was much more difficult this year than it was previous years.
What's in it for Treasury One as a company, though? Because here you are, the boss, going off on jollies around the globe.
Yeah. Now, it's obviously a great marketing opportunity. The car was branded and it's a great experience. But it's for me, it's a passion motorsport. And we piggyback off our passion for motorsport. And we do customer days. We win a local series. We take the customers out. We take them on hot laps. So we give them an experience because the average person doesn't have any idea. I mean, we call it the VW Amarok. But apart from the badge, there's no VW Amarok in there. The same with the Toyota, same with all the other cars. Not even to talk about the Peugeots. The Peugeot is a 50 million rand car that they cost if you want to have a Peugeot. It's just crazy.
What did your Amarok cost?
They're about 3 million rand.
What did you have to do to it to get it race ready for as stringent as this?
No, remember, firstly, they are built, customized built, so it's not a normal Amarok which is converted. They are built from scratch. And then, so once the cars are built and prepared, which they are from the production line, you just take a lot of extra space because the maintenance every day. So it's interesting when you arrive at the bivouac every night, 6, 7 o'clock, if you're lucky, you hand over the keys to the works team, to the mechanics. And they almost every night, they then work through the night. And the next morning when you wake up at 5.
You hope it's ready.
You hope it's ready. And then they give it back to you. And they sleep in the day and then we race. And we get to the next bivouac.
You break it all day and then hand it over.
That's it.
Do you bring it back to deal with Santon's potholes?
Looks like it. I have to.
Henny, it's such a lovely story. Henny de Klerk, Chief Executive at Treasury One, becoming South African team, the first across the line as the rookies in it's still called the Dakar. It's a global brand now, but across Argentina. What a beautiful race. I'm not sure that they saw too much of the scenery, though. They were too busy gritting their teeth and holding on to the steering wheel for dear life. But Henny de Klerk, Chief Executive at Treasury One. The Money Show, brought to you by Old Mutual, a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Get great financial advice. Do great things. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Lee Kasumba, the host of the Africa State of Mind podcast on iTunes, joins us for the Africa Business Report. That's coming up in a couple of minutes' time. And then Dominic Collett, who is Senior Investment Executive at Rand Merchant Investments with the Science of FinTech, the 2018 edition. You loved it last year when we brought her in. And so I'm looking forward to catching up with her and seeing what is hot in the world of FinTech. I did mention this earlier when I was talking to Bright Kumalo from Vestact in our market commentary slot, but the South African investor David Frankel must have loved the new Uber chief executive interview in Davos today. Dara Khosrowshahi has told the audience in Davos that Uber is working way through regulatory issues and will finally be profitable in 3 years' time. It'll continue to be aggressive about expansion. It's finding ways to be more efficient. The company facing various government investigations, of course, the allegations of sexual harassment, the increase in competition from rivals around the world. But the chief executive says that his goal for 2018 is to get back to normalcy. Not that Uber's ever been a normal company, I don't think, but that's what he's looking for. But he does admit, and so many companies, especially so many tech companies that have grown really fast, and Wadara Khosrowshahi admits, says breakneck growth can hide cultural issues. Boy, has he got a point on that one.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
On your number one news and talk station.
Branding and advertising expert Andy Rice on the phone to us tonight. Good evening to you, Andy Rice. How has the week been in advertising with you?
Well, the week's been good. But before we talk about the week, I think I should just point out what a mixed situation I'm in as we speak, because in search of a decent cell phone signal, I've fled outdoors only to find it's raining on me. And since I'm in the Western Cape, I think I have to tolerate that welcome rain.
Andy,
it's making myself a bit damp.
If what it takes is for you to get pneumonia, for the drought to be broken in the Western Cape, I think you'll take one for the
team. I'll be a hero.
You'll be a hero. We'll miss you, but you'll be a hero.
Sacrificing my life for the sake of the Western Cape climate.
I mean, when you say, I mean, rain is a relative concept nowadays anywhere, yes, in the Western Cape. Is it like a Grahamstown drizzle? In other words, you could walk for half an hour without really getting wet, or are there proper raindrops?
I'm afraid it's nearer the former, but it's quite overcast, so let's hope it'll build up some momentum.
Well, we hope so, Andy Rice. Thank good bit of news. Good bit of news from Cape Town this evening. Now, listen, you've been so good about billboards recently. You've been loving billboards, but this one's not a local one.
Well, you know, our regular listener will recall that I am consistently rude about billboards, although, as you rightly point out, they've been a bit better in recent weeks. But I've come across a cracker thanks to Alistair King of the ad agency King James, who put this up on his Twitter feed. And it's taken from a county in Ohio, in the States. And it's a simple conventional billboard which is advertising a drug dealing hotline. Now, you might think that that's quite straightforward, because you automatically conclude that it's saying to people, if you know of anyone who is perhaps guilty of dealing in drugs or handling drugs, and please blow the whistle, here's the number. And it's targeted, obviously, at Mr. and Mrs. Citizen, good, upstanding, non-drug-taking Americans. Except that the headline reads, "Attention drug dealers, report your competition to this number." Now, isn't that clever to actually foster some division between the dealers by suggesting that they report their direct counterparts in other syndicates to this toll-free whistleblowing line? A very clever twist on the traditional method of trying to track down drug dealers.
It's absolutely lovely. Attention, drug dealers, report your competition to our hotline. We should put billboards like that up all over Saxonville, shouldn't we? With maybe different wording. Attention, all looters, report your competition here and give a hotline number. I like it. And we need a zero, Andy. And I know that you're a pluviophile. You know what a pluviophile is?
Someone who loves rain.
Oh, very good. Oh, Andy Rice, you're higher than average education comes through.
My Latin O level comes to the fore.
Latin O level finally has paid off in public. A pluviophile is somebody who loves rain or rainy days. So I want to get you out of the rain. Not that I want the rain to stop in Cape Town, not for a moment. But H&M are blowing it on a weekly basis.
The story that won't lie down, the story that won't go away, or you might say that the gift that keeps on giving. H&M, I haven't seen one campaign create as much negative publicity over a sustained period of time as this one has with H&M. And now they've tried to get on the offensive. They ran a full-page advertisement in the Sunday Times. I'm sure you would have seen it. Big bold headline, "Sorry, we messed up. And then a whole lot of kind of mea culpa apologies through the text. But I think people really don't want to hear those kind of things. They want to know what brands like H&M, who do get on the wrong side of public opinion, what they're going to actually do. in this particular case, they said that they will reach out to all sorts of people to try and get to understand more about diversity and inclusivity, and they welcome contributions from anyone, except they failed to put any kind of contact details on in the ad. So there's nowhere does it say if you have got a contribution to make, here's our email address, here's my phone number, whatever. So it does seem a little bit half-hearted. And I think that while I still stand by my view that in a few months' time, all will be forgiven and forgotten, I do think that they're handling this particularly poorly at the moment.
I mean, in this sort of case, you've got to put up a hotline number or give the CEO's cell phone number out for 24 hours and say, look, the CEO is going to be available on this line. Phone and shout at the CEO if you really are of a mind to. And the CEO should take the calls, frankly, and listen and take notes and act on those notes. But Andy Rice, are you going to blow away in the wind in Cape Town? Branding and advertising expert Andy Rice, pluviophile Andy Rice on the line to us from Cape Town, where there is a faint but moist and welcome drizzle.
The Money Show.
The Africa Business Report.
Africa Business Report this evening, Lee Kasumba standing by for us tonight. Lee Kasumba is the host of the Africa State of Mind podcast, which you can find on iTunes from Johannesburg this evening. Lee Kasumba, welcome back to The Money Show. Public health in Zambia, controversy with public health versus actually making a living. Tell me the tale.
Yeah, so basically, last year, the Ministry of Health declared that, you know, there was a cholera outbreak in Zambia. So about 60 people have died since October to date. And, you know, the Zambian government has been trying to do everything that they can to curb the outbreak from, you know, going even further. And basically, what has happened is that they've called in the military, they've implemented curfews, and the latest sector to be hit are the informal traders. And what government has decided and what they've thought is that if they can close down some of the informal traders in the markets, you know, they can help stop the spread of cholera, because obviously, you know, there's a lot of selling of food and there's a lot of selling of drink, which is not doing anything, but especially when they call these specific areas as being unsanitary conditions. And one of the biggest things, you know, that people, we almost need to understand, is that within the Zambian community, the informal traders, people basically, they make money from day to day, so it's hand to mouth, and a large number of people rely on this to be able to feed their children, to be able to run their households, because there isn't as much access to the economy in general. And also, a lot of politicians do tend to go to the informal markets come, you know, election season in order to be able to garner. So that's how powerful they are. But right now, the government has really pulled out all their stops. They want to stop the outbreak, and they've gone, you know, with an unprecedented move to shut down the markets. And a lot of the traders were not even told. So there have been quite a few riots that are going on. So it looks like the government has chosen the route of, you know, saving people in terms of public health versus people, you know, and their livelihood. So we'll have to watch the story and see how it really goes.
And you're going to wonder just how draconian the South African government is going to get in terms of listeriosis in this country.
Yes.
When you look at the Zambians are doing with cholera, listeriosis is as deadly.
It is equally as deadly. And, you know, obviously it does always come down to the whole factor around the money versus the health. And those are two very important, you know, very, very important either way. So it'll be interesting to see how the South African government does respond to it before it becomes an epidemic like what we've seen in Zambia. And the outbreak of cholera has now also, you know, there have been reports about how in parts of Zimbabwe also we've seen, you know, some cholera cases being reported there. So we'll see how that all goes.
Well, what's your assessment of the new Zimbabwean government so far? It's a month old or thereabouts, more than a month old. A lot of positive noises seem to be coming out. There's talk about land. There's talk all about, of course, the property issues within Zimbabwe, and now some reforms coming in terms of minerals and mineral rights for Zimbabwe.
Yeah, I think, you know, to be really honest, I was a little bit skeptical initially, only because the current president was obviously the vice president for a while. And I had that question that a lot of people did, which was, why didn't you do something sooner, you know? But so far, the new president has proved me wrong. As mentioned, you know, as you've mentioned, there has been a lot of positive noise. So we've seen him, you know, call out to investors and different countries that were kicked out in terms of doing business in Zimbabwe. So he's made a huge call for that. He also has, you know, made a huge call where he's gotten private companies to subsidize some of the homing, the housing situations in the main cities, because there is a backlog of about 1 million people who still need housing. And in order to get the economy up and running again, what they really need to do is to have people working in the city and living in the city and being able to afford it. So the subsidies go up, you know, they go up pretty high. And if depending on the kind of job that you have, you'll end up paying about $100 per month, which is close to nothing if you really think about it. So I think that's really positive. And then one of the biggest moves is that obviously in 2009, Zimbabwe had adopted the US dollar as the currency that they would use with regards to import tax where diesel and fuel were concerned. And currently Zimbabweans pay the most for petrol and fuel in the SADC region. Now, these numbers are pretty shocking when I did the conversions. For petrol, you're paying about $1.41, which is about 17 rand a liter of petrol. And for diesel, you're paying about $1.33, which is about 16 rand a liter for diesel. And what he's done is that he's cut this down by 17%. So I'm sure a lot of people in Zimbabwe are really relieved, because as we know, you know, fuel and the price of petrol really impacts people's ability to be able to move about, the ability for goods to be sent to different stores and all the rest. And that obviously directly impacts the community. So it is looking pretty positive. I guess, you know, come the elections, the first free and fair elections since Robert Mugabe, we'll have to see how this momentum holds up and if the people of Zimbabwe really do trust him as a leader.
Now, it's so interesting that he's been calling, and you notice that both you and I are avoiding saying Emmerson Mnangagwa. We're both avoiding saying it, and I'm brave. I'm okay. But Emmerson, President Emmerson, he has actually been very, very vocal about ensuring and inviting observers to say, look, when we do have this first free and fair election, we want you to come, we want you to observe, and we want you to pronounce on these elections that we are going to hold. He's committing to democracy. He's committing to transparency. And so far, so good, frankly.
Yeah, and I think it's also a pretty smart move, because if he comes across to the Zimbabwean people as being totally opposite and really pushing a lot of reforms in such a short period of time, you know, the tendency is to go for the person who you see change happening almost immediately. So I think even from that perspective, it shows how politically savvy he really is, you know. So I think, yeah, I actually think, I could be wrong, but I think that we could see a win with him with these elections coming up.
And then Bank of Tanzania is getting a little bit grumpy about the banking sector in that country, and the regulators are clamping down.
Yeah, so basically in Tanzania, in order to be a bank that is up and running, you need to have a minimum of $800,000 of cash, you know, of capital, sorry, in your bank. And five banks came up short, and really, really short, you know. So there was a report that had gone on, and there was an inquiry for a long time. And so in December 2017, the president of Tanzania basically gave the word saying, look, come January, if they don't meet the standards, we need to shut it down. We need to shut these banks down. So the banks were closed. And when you look at what's happened in countries like Uganda, where banks just overnight, suddenly, you know, the banks are no more, it obviously destabilizes the economy. And, it, you know, it just isn't good for the entire, for the growth of the country as a whole. And of course, the IMF has been really supportive of this move. And, you know, we're not really surprised, because the Tanzanian president, since he's been there the past few years, he really has gone headstrong, making reforms. He just does what he feels is best in his mind for the people of Tanzania, whether it makes him popular or not. He's all about results. So this is quite a big move from his side.
Most certainly is. Lee Kasumba, thank you very much. Host of the Africa State of Mind podcast. Lovely podcasting stories from around the African continent. It's hosted by Lee Kasumba. She has got a passion for the continent and for stories of money from around the continent as well. Lee Kasumba, regular contributor to The Money Show in our Africa Business Report.
To The Money Show. Bruce is on Twitter. At Bruce Business.
Do you still use classifieds? Do you use Gumtree? Are you online? There still are classifieds in newspapers. I mean, the newspapers used to have a whole separate pull-out section when I was a kid, and would sort of whack down on the table, almost as heavy as the chunky newspapers were in the day. Nowadays, newspapers are a shadow of their former selves, of course, and the newspaper classified except for, I think, a couple of naughty bits and obituaries, are all but dead. But it's interesting to see that Facebook is introducing its marketplace service in South Africa. It's hoping to disrupt what's left, I suppose, of the local classifieds industry in the form of what it is in newspapers and other publications. But the feature within Facebook app is launched in, 47 countries? More than 550 million people from around the world visit the platform and they buy and sell goods each month. So what it looks like is Facebook is looking to take on the new generation of classifieds. And if you're in that sort of business, you must be nipping a little bit because of Facebook's extraordinary reach and the way in which Facebook does its business. It's completely ruthless in the way in which it executes its business. Facebook app users in South Africa, in the next couple of weeks, will see a new marketplace icon in the app, and that will enable you to access then that marketplace, the new world of classifieds, taking on not only what's left of newspaper classifieds and what happens at that one page in the back of Newsweek, plus, of course, all of the new platforms that have opened over the years. Will they be able to survive in the face of a Facebook onslaught?
The Money Show.
The Science of...
So this time last year, we invited Dominic Collett from Rand Merchant Investments, who is, she's a senior investment executive, to give us the South African fintech perspective in 2017. And she was so good, and you liked her so much, and you listened to the podcast so much, and she's blushing, well, she will, that we thought we'd get her back in 2018 to give us a perspective as to the way in which the world of fintech, financial technology, the stuff that underpins so much of the revolution that is happening in financial services nowadays, talk all about that. This time last year, you were talking about Bitcoin and what a big deal it would become. And it became a huge deal, perhaps an overhyped, overenthused deal. But the world suddenly, August, September, I don't know if it was the change of season or what it was, but the world started going completely mad over Bitcoin.
No, it was quite phenomenal to see. I mean, Bitcoin is something that we've been studying as a team and something I've certainly been interested in since about 2013. And it went from being this very obscure, very geeky, very out there, almost leftist anarchist interest group to last year exploding on the scene. And I think what really happened was that you had 2014 and 2015, a lot of very smart people, a lot of bankers, a lot of venture capitalists starting to apply their mind to Bitcoin and to blockchain. So the momentum was starting. And I think last year would really it on was the announcement that it was going to be traded on the futures exchange. I think that was it was a signal that Wall Street was now taking this seriously and it was being taken seriously by institutional investors. So all the naysayers who for years had been saying this, I mean, you must remember every time Bitcoin has been called a bubble since it hit $500.
I did it at 11 in a Sunday Times column. It went to 20 grand. It's now below what when I call it a bubble, just for the record.
So it's been the most astonishing thing. People have been calling this thing a bubble, speculative ether, you know, there's nothing to it for the last 3 years. And
there is nothing to it other than the blockchain and other than belief and faith and buy-in by enough people to take a limited resource and to push up its value, which is what the scarcity principle is all about.
Exactly. But what is the financial services system if not a system of trust?
Yeah. And then how important is it that Bitcoin works? Because if enough people go for Bitcoin or fall for Bitcoin and start believing in Bitcoin, and if it does go bust, and it might, that will undermine trust, won't it, at some point? I know this is a matter of hot dispute in financial technology and in the sanctity and the trust that exists in the financial system. If I put money into a set of numbers that represent your bank account today and I tell you that I've done it and I send you an email that got a proof of payment, you haven't got the money yet, but you believe it'll come because the financial system works. If it stops working, we lose faith.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that's what the financial services system is built on. I mean, that's what we saw happen in the 2008 crisis. People lost faith in the system. And it's no coincidence that Bitcoin was launched in 2008 post that crisis. So there's no doubt if we do see a failure of Bitcoin that we are going to get a few wobbles. But I think there's so much other momentum that's moving underneath this that I think something else will come up and take its place. The thing to remember in my view on this with Bitcoin is that even if its value, even if it starts to lose value, the point is that 18 months ago, no one had ever heard of Bitcoin. So if you told people that you could pay for things on Takealot or you could pay for things, you could buy your Starbucks coffee with Bitcoin, they wouldn't
have
known.
You get a red and yellow academy in Cape Town education in creative thinking and creative business thinking, paying in Bitcoins.
Exactly.
Yeah.
18 months ago, people hadn't heard of it and there was no ability of mass adoption. So even if the value falls, people are aware of this thing called cryptocurrency. So they now start to understand that there is an alternative payment mechanism.
But you believe in it so much that you guys have invested in Luno, which is one of the platforms on which you can trade these cryptocurrencies, right?
Correct. So it's South Africa's largest. So they're obviously an exchange and they are wallets. So it's very important for us when we're looking at the Bitcoin landscape, we wanted a universal player. So you obviously get people who have specialized just on being an exchange or people that are specializing in being a wallet. We said it's quite important to own the whole value system.
So what is the difference to the uneducated of an exchange and a wallet, and why is it important that those two things are connected?
So the difference really is you can think of Luno as a bank account for your Bitcoin. So because it's got that storage capability, they'll store it on your behalf. So they have something called hot storage, they have something called cold storage, so that if it's in cold storage or in deep freeze, as they call it, it means that it's literally locked away in bank vaults on your behalf, because obviously
but locked away in virtual bank vaults. These are digital bank vaults.
Well, sometimes you've actually got to print out the details of your Bitcoin wallet, and sometimes you've actually got to put it into a physical vault. I know a lot of people who do that. So it's quite extraordinary. So the point is that you need to find someone who you trust with your belongings, in the same way that you trust a bank to hold your deposits. It's not always the same institution that you trust to do your trading. So what's really happened with Luno is that they set out and they said, we want to make sure that everyone can get into this thing called Bitcoin, that it doesn't matter what your fiat currency is, you can buy Bitcoin. And then once you've bought it, you need to be able to store it somewhere safely. So it's that full customer experience journey, which particularly in a market like South Africa, which is quite small, which requires quite a lot of education, it was quite important to pick a player like that.
Okay, so are the wallets the vaults?
Correct.
Okay, got you.
The wallets are your vaults where you can see your balance, where you can transact, where you can send. And the exchange is really where they make the market. So they try and match Bitcoin sellers and Bitcoin buyers.
What is the speed of settlement? The JSE prides itself, for example, on T plus three. So transaction plus 3 days. If you sell your Steinhoff share, at an agreed price, you will get whatever you've agreed to sell it for 3 days later. What's it in the world of Luno?
So in the world of Luno, it obviously works on the Bitcoin protocol. So if you send someone from one Bitcoin address to another, in theory, it should settle within 10 minutes. But obviously, we know one of the biggest issues that's sitting on the Bitcoin network currently is speed of processing of transactions, which is why the miners are getting paid quite big fees to process these transactions. So at the moment, there will be a bit of a time delay based on how congested the Bitcoin network is. But it's not T plus three, that we can say. There are fees that are having to be paid to speed you up and move you to the front of the queue. But that is now looking to be solved by something called the Lightning Network. So over the phenomenal thing about Bitcoin is these communities that develop around it.
But these things, it's like there is a problem, let's resolve the problem. And somebody else comes up with the idea to solve the problem. And that's what is, I think, what blows my mind about one is used to going to a bank and it having a process and a system that you would recognize from the 1980s, for example. When you're dealing in this space, the solution could be found by a 12-year-old popping pimples tomorrow as they think up some crazy new scheme to get access to your real-world money, your fiat money.
Sure, but at the same time, I think one of the biggest concerns, I mean, the reason why Bitcoin came out was that, we saw happening in the 2008 crisis, we maybe lost a bit of faith in these centralized institutions and some of these regulators who should have been overseeing this. So really, the theory around this is you've got this Bitcoin community, and we've seen two big forks happen. We've seen Bitcoin hat, and we've seen Bitcoin Cash, and we're now seeing the Lightning Network being developed. And really, you've got a community of people who are saying, we're going to solve the problems. We're not going to wait for a central authority who may not understand the product, who may not understand the users of the product, and collectively we're going to do this together. It's a bit of a wisdom of crowds thing. It's very contrary to what the financial services system has been built on.
And everybody has got the same sort of focus of hatred in 2008. It's the system, it's the central banks, it's the politicians, it's the banks and leverage, and that's where it all went wrong. Who are they going to hate when Bitcoin goes wrong? There's no central control to hate, so we hate each other.
Well, likely what will happen is what they call them the Bitcoin whales. These are the guys who sit on huge stacks of Bitcoin. They're also called hodlers. And there is a bit of market manipulation because they hold such big storage. So if it all goes to pot, then maybe we'll be turning, pointing a finger at the hodlers and the whales.
But you'll never know who they are and where they are. That's the trouble with it, you see. Just call me old school. InsurTech. Now, yes. There are marvelous things happening in the world of insurance.
Yes.
I met the chief executive of one of the biggest insurance companies in the world last year, Allianz, and they run their house using the Amazon.com Echo. What's her name?
Alexa.
Alexa. Alexa runs their lives. Alexa, what is on Johnny's diary today? Alexa then says, Johnny is going to school, and then Johnny is going to do football. Then Johnny will be home at 3:30. And then Dad knows, and Mom knows everybody else's business, because Alexa's in charge. It was freaky to hear the stories. But and this is the chief executive of one of the biggest insurance companies in the world, who loves that, and is then adapting it into the world of insurance. And that's what's changing that industry.
Which is fantastic, because you're getting more data points. So really what this is about is it's bringing product into people's lives. So I think what's exciting for me about fintech generally, and certainly now InsurTech, is it's saying we've got to recognize that society has changed. We've got to recognize that our consumers have changed. We've got the rise of the millennials, who have a fundamentally different view of the world. We've got the rise of computing power, and we've got these new technologies. No longer do we sit in our ivory towers and design products and push them into the consumers that say this is how you should insure your product. The reason stories like that are so exciting is because you're saying we're trying to recognize what's happening in the world, and at the end of the day we're trying to recognize our consumer. How are they living? What are they doing on a daily basis? And how do we, as the large big institution, tailor our product to you?
Imagine that.
It's extraordinary.
It's crazy. Absolutely crazy. We're going to talk more about chatbots, about digital fika, about robo-advisors, and whether or not financial advisors will be around 5 years from now. Lawyers and accountants, 5 years, 4 years, 3 years, 10 years from now. What's your bet as to what profession will fall first, I wonder? Talking about that in just a moment.
The Money Show.
The Science of...
Machines are becoming more and more clever, and they are making our lives considerably more simple, but they are also catching us out if we try and juke the system. You guys invested in a business in the UK called Hastings. What does Hastings do?
So Hastings is basically the equivalent of OUTsurance in the UK. So it's a large direct short-term insurer, but it's completely digital. So they don't, basically how they work is off price comparison websites. So in the UK, everyone buys insurance through Compare the Market or Money Supermarket. And they get loads of quotes, and then they decide which provider they're going through. And what Hastings did very cleverly is they said, instead of building a brand on our own and spending a lot of money above the line, for example, what an OUTsurance does, we're going to build our brand purely through these price comparison websites. So their predictive analytics capability is incredibly strong, that they always know that they can price your product in such a way that they're always as number two or number three on the price comparison website so that you choose them. So it's a very clever business. It's growing really fast. We've seen significant market share. So it's a very exciting investment for us. And it's a good example of what's happening in the world of InsurTech.
I mean, is that something that you'll bring here with Hastings, or are we developing things differently here?
So in South Africa, we haven't really seen the rise of price comparison websites. So we obviously have one.
There was Hippo, but the Hippo turned out to be just the Auto and General Group comparing its own prices. Then they got bust. And then they included a whole bunch of other things too.
So the challenge, what we've seen, and we track these price comparison websites globally because we do want to understand, because they have a big impact on the insurance market. So in the UK, once what we call the PCWs came in, we saw a lot of margin shift out of the insurance companies. So insurers globally have been very wary of these price comparison websites because of what's happened in the UK. So in South Africa, certainly the large insurers haven't gone onto the price comparison website. So they are trying to defend themselves to a point. So,
but they won't be able to do it forever. And that's the interesting thing is 5 years from now, this insurance market looks completely different. And I'm not sure that they've got a grip on it.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think we're in a very fortunate position. We look at the insurance companies that we have in our portfolio, being Discovery, being OUTsurance, and being MMI. And we certainly work with those innovation teams in those businesses to keep them up to date with all the trends that are happening. And, you know, we try and encourage them to have in-house innovation teams, to run accelerators, and to be working with the there's startups out there that can help them jump this curve, because digital disruption is coming. If you're not ahead of the curve, you are going to get lost. And that's why stories, for example, with OutSurance have been so exciting. We, for example, where they've launched OutFest, which is one of the first big robo-advisors in South Africa. They're going on that digital journey on their app so that you can now do claims on your windscreen via the app, etc., so that they're ready for this wave when it comes.
What is Lemonade?
So Lemonade is a really interesting business in the US. It started in Brooklyn. And really what it allows you to do is insure in particular items for a period of time. So for example, if you buy a really expensive ski jacket and you're going on a holiday skiing, you want to insure it for the time that you're out and about skiing, and then you turn the insurance off. Or you borrow a friend's watch and it's an expensive watch, or a pair of earrings for the evening, and you insure that particular item for a particular period of time. So what was interesting about Lemonade was that they tapped into the psyche of these millennials who generally don't own property, but they have a lot of their savings in high-end items like clothing or jewelry or shoes, etc., and they allow them to insure those products. They also worked on a lot of data in terms of they started out in particular areas of Brooklyn, and they used a lot of community data to inform the pricing of their products, and they've slowly expanded state by state. But it's a really clever business model.
And the chatbots are quite unnerving. You think you're talking to Megan because there is a photograph. People are interacting now with chatbots. They think they're interacting with people, but they're interacting with an algorithm that has a human face.
Yeah.
And the algorithm is simply asking questions in a particular sequence and has then got a range of responses to depending on your response to the question. And these chatbots are taking orders in the digital world.
Correct. Look, I think the most successful chatbots we've certainly seen in the financial services space are the chatbots that work through existing messenger apps. So there's a lot of really good chatbots in the Facebook Messenger app. And I think it's almost where there's this staged... So I go from sort of speaking to a call center environment to doing a few little mundane things through the Facebook chatbot, because I think it's a customer journey. People have to get used to doing certain things with computers. But I mean, what's interesting, there's a business like Zona, which is a money transfer business in Zambia, which operates in quite rural areas of Zambia. And traditionally, they've only really used USSD, their customers and their agents. And they launched a Facebook chatbot to enable their agents to engage with their call center more frictionally and more easily. So if you look at that, I mean, it's quite astonishing that they chose to go the chatbot route in deepest, darkest Zambia.
Yeah, it is. It is really interesting. The fintech startups to watch in 2018. Now, you mentioned Luno, but that's one of your own.
Correct.
So let's talk about a competitor. Let's talk about Carry, because that's out of Nedbank. I thought that was rather big of you to give. Have you got an investment in there as well?
No, we don't.
Okay, just checking. And Carry is this app that's been advertised on the radio, which makes so much sense, because when you're a parent and kids need 37 cents to go and do this, or 3.70 or more likely 370.
I was about to say, it's definitely not 3 rand.
It's a bit like the Lemonade insurance principle. You can pay small amounts of money as and when required, quickly and seamlessly.
Correct. So the reason we think Carry is so interesting is A, it is still an independent fintech business, and B, they're actually delivering a service that solves a real pain point for customers. So I think the fintech businesses that we see scaling and the ones that we see being really successful are finding a big pain point for customers and coming in with a slick solution. So, and they're targeting a specific community, because that's the other thing. When you launch a fintech business, you want to make sure that you've got a very early adopter and a super user in the beginning. And school communities are incredibly close. They've got a very specific use case. And it's, I think from a market entry perspective, what that team has done is extraordinary.
Okay. So when you look at pain points and slick solutions, and that is the joy of fintech right now, because they're going around, they're finding the gaps, they're finding the problems and seeking to fix those problems. Are we finding South African developers fixing South African problems, or are they either directly or inadvertently solving global problems?
So, I mean, I'll give you an example. Again, I'm going to punt one of our own investments. But
well, you know it well.
I know it well. And it's a great success story, and that's being Intersect. So Intersect provides mobile banking authentication. So they came up with a product, this is now almost 9 years ago, to replace the one-time password. And the one-time password is problematic because of SIM swaps and because of phishing. And they developed a technology, and effectively what they allow you to do, it's a USSD screen that comes up and says, is this you, yes or no, and I'm going to approve the transaction. So it started in a basement in Stellenbosch by a group of university students, has now scaled into a global business. They're covering clients globally. They're working with banks in Australia, in the US, in Europe, and they're cutting edge. So that's the most extraordinary thing, is that they solved a problem, because SIM swap fraud in South Africa is a huge issue,
so big.
And it's only now hitting Australia. And it's only now hitting Europe.
We're so advanced, you know.
we're so advanced when it comes to crime.
We're so good at fraud. We should actually advertise that. We are great at fraud.
So when Intersect are speaking to their clients over there, they can say, we've been dealing with this problem for 8 years and our solution really works for you. So, I mean, another example is Prodigy Finance, which is a business that was born in Cape Town. It's led by South Africans, but it's a truly global business, providing postgraduate student loans to students who are going to the top universities around the world. So, you know, I think that's the most exciting thing about the South African fintech scene, is the caliber of entrepreneurs here. They are able to scale their product internationally. I mean, it's not always easy, but they are solving problems that are applicable globally.
I like the sound of Isazi Consulting. It's about adding meaning to data. And one of the biggest problems that we've got is this splurging of data all over the internet, all over the web, billions and billions of bytes of noise every single day. And to be able to extract meaning from that is so incredibly powerful.
It is. And I think why Isazi in particular have been so successful is that, again, they're a homegrown South African team. They're a group of academics predominantly that came out of the Wits University environment. I think between the three founders, I think they've got something crazy like 7 PhDs.
And a combined age of 37. Yes.
And they started to solve, while they were still at Wits and they were still lecturing, they were solving problems for corporates using maths. And they realized that this was actually a business model. So I think what's refreshing about them is they don't provide a one product fits all, because they're recognizing that data analytics is an art. It's not a science. It's an art. So if you get really clever teams who can understand data, can work with data, and are very creative in what problems they're solving, you produce magic.
I've got time for one more. Tell me one more story of what we're doing in South Africa that's awesome in the world of fintech.
Electrum.
Click2Sure, I don't know.
So Click2Sure is a really exciting business. So Click2Sure is allowing you to do insurance online. So they've got an agreement with, for example, WeFix, and they've got an agreement now with Takealot. So when you're doing a big purchase online, so you're buying your, you know, your latest phone online, or you're buying your latest TV, an option pops up straight away to say, can we insure this item? I think what's exciting about a business like they're developing products for, you know, for insurance products that are relevant to the consumer. So micro products, so insuring a TV or insuring a phone. And they're also doing it in a digitally friendly way. So they're coming to where the consumer is doing the shopping.
But they need a squillion transactions in order to become profitable, don't they?
They do. That is the one thing about fintech, is that it takes a long time to scale. It takes quite a long time to build a brand, and it takes a lot of money.
And that's the problem with it. I mean, I was talking to Stephen Sard at the end of last year to say they're producing pills that take a million steps and they sell them for $2. But they've been doing it for a long time.
Yes.
And we have to get to a point where you're getting $2 transaction costs out of these things when they're selling a million units an hour.
Yes, correct. And it's a scale game. I mean, that really
And it's
is,
got to go global.
It's got to go global. That's why businesses like Prodigy Finance and Luna are doing so extraordinarily well, because they're solving global problems, but they're sitting on a South African cost base.
Dominic Collett, fabulous stories as always. Senior Investment Executive at Rand Merchant Investments. South African fintech in 2018. There is smart stuff happening within our borders. Dominic Collett telling us some of those tales.